From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll hear from a Wisconsin judge who attended one of the first desegregated schools in the nation. We'll tell you about Milwaukee Road and how the company encouraged tourism to national parks out west.
The Milwaukee Road was at a disadvantage to begin with because they were so far from the park. So what they decided to do was build a very nice, luxurious hotel that was in a town called Salesville, which later changed its name to the Gallatin Gateway.
Plus, we'll explore the history of the real-life Mrs. Maisels, female Jewish comedians who paved the way for women in comedy.
People have really strong stereotypes of what Jewish women are like that are haunting that microphone before the performer even opens her mouth.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Today, we'll highlight some of the standout moments from last week's Democratic National Convention, where Vice President Kamala Harris officially accepted her nomination as the party's presidential candidate. But we'll start with the 1954 landmark decision in Brown v. Board of Education. The U.S. Supreme Court found school segregation unconstitutional. But the path to desegregating schools hasn't been straightforward. In the following decades, states that had resisted desegregation were forced to follow the law. New segregation academies popped up in small towns throughout the South, like Leland, Mississippi, a town of about 6,000 people in the Mississippi Delta. Leland's experience desegregating its public schools is the subject of a documentary from PBS called The Harvest. It features a number of the students who were part of the first generation of kids desegregating schools, including Pam Pepper, a U.S. District Court judge for the Eastern District of Wisconsin. Pepper was one of the few white students who returned to Leland's public schools, and she joins me to talk about her experience and the documentary. During the docuseries, both you and the other people featured in this series really paint this as a black and white culture. And it seems so odd having grown up in such a small town because I can't quite picture that. When you were growing up there, was the town itself very segregated? People just lived on one side or the other?
Yes. It was physically segregated. The town has a beautiful creek that sort of bisects it going one direction. And there's a railroad track that bisects it going perpendicular. So the town's almost just in quadrants, if you will. And when I was growing up, for the most part, white people lived on one side of the railroad track creek divide and black people lived on another. And as best I can tell, since I've been back as an adult, it is still that way.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Growing up, you initially in elementary school went to something we now kind of call segregation academies. These were schools that popped up pretty quickly after Mississippi, and I believe other states were forced to desegregate their schools. What was it like going to one of these segregation academies?
It's a little bit hard to answer that question because, keep in mind, I started first grade in the 1970 school year. Brown versus Board of Education was decided in 1954. Mississippi managed to resist integration for 16 years until finally there was a Supreme Court case that directly said to Mississippi, you have to do it and you have to do it now. So I went into first grade that year. I had no consciousness of any of that. I just went to school where I got dropped off to go to school. And as you pointed out, it was a very tiny town. And so a lot of the kids I went to school with at the quote-unquote academy, the white school, were kids I knew from my neighborhood and kids I played with when I was little. I remember the physical geography of it because it was out on the highway, there wasn't any landscaping. It was all kind of dusty and dirty surrounding it. We weren't near anything, really. My recollection is, and I could be wrong, but my recollection is that there had been some sort of either tractor storage facility or it had been something else. It had been, the building had been, I thought, something else. and it got turned quickly into a school.
Now, your parents decided to, after elementary school, move you into the public school system. At this point, in Leland, the public schools were almost entirely black. The vast majority of white students had gone to these academies, or is that not?
I wouldn't say almost entirely black. By the time I went to middle school, which is when I went to the public school, I would say probably maybe 18 to 20% white and 80% black. So a lot of white families had sent their kids to the academies or to parochial schools. But there were more white students in the public school at that time than I think there are now.
Wow.
Yeah.
When it came to the schools themselves, something that is talked about in the docuseries is that there was, of course, this requirement to desegregate the schools. In theory, of course, we have these segregation academies that pop up, but even inside the schools themselves, it seemed like there was still some level of segregation, whether it was, you know, creating different reading classes in which kids would end up being segregated, or having segregated dances and things of that ilk. What was that like?
You're sort of asking about two separate things. The different classes that you're talking about, that happened at the elementary school level. I was not a part of that because I was not at the public school at that time. But one of the things that happened, you know, there was still resistance to integration, even though it was happening and it was required. And so there were these groups called ability groups that were created. And kids in first, second, third, fourth, fifth grade were put in quote-unquote ability groups. Ostensibly, it was the higher performing students went in the group A and the lower performing students went in group E or whatever it went to. In reality, it was another way to separate white students and black students. And I think if you watched The Harvest, my friend Van Poindexter, a classmate, talked very poignantly about the fact that, I mean, he's one of the smartest people I know and always has been. And he ended up in a lower ability group, and he was determined he was not going to allow that to continue, and he worked his way up to the higher ability group. That was a part that I didn't really see because I didn't come to the school till later. The separate dances and things, that was more, you know, nobody ever said black and white kids aren't going to go to dances together, or black and white kids after the football game on Friday night are going to go to two different places to hang out. It was not dictated. It was not required by the schools or anything of that nature. That's the part that I look back on, I think, in some respects with the most regret, because it just, nobody really questioned it. It just was what it was. Football game got over and everybody slapped everybody on the back and waved. And then the black kids, you know, went over to where they went and the white kids went to where they went. I did never invite a black friend over to first spend the night, you know, and I look back now and think, why not? We sat together for 8-9 hours a day. We did sports together. We did extracurricular activities together. I had friends, and yet that friendship stopped as soon as the school activities stopped. As one person said in the film, over the summers, you know, we hardly saw each other at all. And it wasn't like anybody decided it or said it. It just was the way it was. And that I look back on with a tremendous amount of regret. That I wish I had just looked over one day and said, do you want to come over to my house after school and seen what happened?
One of the things you've mentioned is Leland today is in some ways more segregated. We, of course, also live in a city that has hyper-segregated schools. In some ways, it feels like your generation in Leland was part of this kind of grand experiment that, for a variety of reasons, kind of failed. We continue to have hyper-segregated schools in places like Leland and in our community here in Milwaukee. How do you view what happened with your generation growing up in the context of this larger conversation about desegregating schools and the continued necessity for it?
It's hard to answer. I've thought a lot about it since I was asked to participate in the documentary. The person who made it was a classmate of mine from grade school. And on a micro level, how do I view it? I view my experience as pure dumb luck. It was a wonderful thing for me. Junior high and high school were wonderful for me. And I was lucky enough to be fairly oblivious to how unique that experience was, how fraught it was in other places. At the same time, sometimes I was so oblivious that I didn't quite realize that there were tensions around me that I just wasn't aware of. But I will always be grateful for that experience and what gift it gave me of, you know, just learning that being around people who are different than you is a good thing, and it enriches your life. But on a broader scale, I've thought a lot about, you know, what didn't work? Was it the fact that having people sit together next to each other in class for 8 hours a day, but then not having them interact in some of the most important aspects of their lives, their families, their churches, their social activities, was that a forecast for doom? That you can't just kind of force it in one false construct? It has to be somewhere else? I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that the housing piece was not going along with the school piece. If people are living in separate communities, and I wonder sometimes if that's not a Milwaukee issue as well for our community, that if people are living in different communities, they are going to want to go to school in their community. They're going to want to go to school with other people who they know who've had the same experience that they have had. And maybe that's racially motivated, but maybe it's just, this is what's familiar to me. My parents went to this school. Their parents went to this school. And if those communities are separate, then the schools are going to be separate. And I honestly don't know. And, you know, Wisconsin's been through so many iterations of, there was desegregation, and then there was a suburban desegregation litigation. There's been lots of litigation around voucher schools. People come at it from 8 million different directions, and yet the problem persists, and it makes you wonder if there's something more deep-seated or more rooted than just, we've got white people and black people in the same school together for Monday through Friday. Does there need to be something more than that? Do we need to reach each other in some way beyond that and interact with each other in some way beyond that? And I don't know I wish I knew what the answer is. I sure don't.
I think if you had the answer, you'd be a very rich person.
I think I think I would consider some life work to have been done, yes.
Well, Pam, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect, sharing your experiences.
Thank you for having me. I'm grateful to talk about it, and I hope that people will watch The Harvest, not so much because of my participation, but Doug Blackman and Sam Pollard did a lot of work over a lot of years, and it's an effort of love on their part, so I hope people will watch it. I was
born by the river. Judge Pam Pepper is a U.S. District Court judge for the Eastern District of Wisconsin, and one of the subjects of the PBS documentary, The Harvest. We spoke last year. Ever since, it's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
From Milwaukee's NPR, this is Capital Notes. We break down the big political news affecting Wisconsin. I'm Chuck Quernbach, filling in for Mayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WisPolitics.com. Here's our latest conversation. Well, hi, J.R. Welcome to the post-convention. This isn't Mayan, this is Chuck, edition of Capital Notes.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So there's a lot to talk about. I'll start with some ballot issues. Robert Kennedy has ceased his campaign and thrown his support to Donald Trump. What does that mean for Wisconsin?
Well, he'll still be on the ballot most likely, even if he's not campaigning here aggressively. And so what I mean by that is, and I'll try not to be too much of a dork about the law, but Kennedy turned in nomination papers in early August by the deadline to get on the ballot as an independent candidate. The Election Commission is going to meet tomorrow to consider those petitions and decide if he is qualified for the ballot. His campaign said he turned in more than twice the 2,000 needed to qualify. The thing is with state law in Wisconsin is once you turn in nomination papers, you can't ask for them back. And unless there's a problem with those papers, he'll be on the ballot. Now, the commission staff will go over those papers and have a recommendation going to the meeting and if the commissioners themselves determine if they're sufficient. But barring a major flaw, he'll be on the ballot in Wisconsin come November. The question is, how does it impact things? Go back and look at the last Marquette Law School poll. You know, Kennedy had dropped from being at 16% in January to about 8%. That's still probably high for where he might have been come November, even if he stayed in. Our history with third-party candidates in Wisconsin has a lot of flirtations with them early, but we usually shy away from them come November. But anyway, of the people supporting him in the last poll, 10% were self-identified Republicans, 4% were Democrats. So in theory, it would probably help Donald Trump. Now, in practice, the question is, are those Republicans who were backing Kennedy, will they go over to Trump? Are they Republicans who want a protest option? They're not happy with Donald Trump, they're looking for somebody else to vote for? Or what do those folks do? It's a huge question. The Trump campaign was already trumpeting after Kennedy's announcement that they were going to get a big boost from this. And so we'll see.
So we've got this other ballot fight. The Democrats are trying to knock Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein off the Wisconsin ballot. Where do things stand with that?
Well, we're waiting for the Supreme Court to issue something any minute now, essentially. There were some deadlines set last week in this lawsuit that basically argues the Green Party is not eligible to have a presidential candidate on the ballot in Wisconsin. The Green Party this time went the route of qualifying by having a candidate get at least 1% of the vote in a statewide race, which happened in 2022 with their Secretary of State candidate. And then you have to, as part of that process, pick a slate of electors who are the people who actually cast the votes for Wisconsin Electoral College, right? Well, to pick an elector, you have to be basically an office holder or a candidate for the Assembly of the Senate. The Greens don't have anybody in Wisconsin who qualifies for that during this cycle. The suit basically says, well, if you can't pick an elector, you can't have an elector. You don't have electors, you can't be a candidate. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not going to try and play one and say that's going to be an effective argument, but the court is moving quickly because there are some deadlines coming up. We talked about the Elections Commission meeting on Tuesday to certify the candidates for the ballot. Well, then local clerks begin printing ballots. They have a deadline in mid-September to have ballots printed and sent to local clerks, then must send them to those who have a request for an absentee ballot on file. Some clerks I've talked to told me it takes 2, sometimes 3 weeks to get their ballots printed. They don't want to delay. We are getting close to crunch time here. So the court is moving quickly. It's not unprecedented, but it's unusual how quickly they're moving. They get this case rolling to see whether they're going to take it and how they're going to rule. But it's something to watch in the coming days because, again, that's going to affect things. I've cautioned people that Greens that I've talked to don't necessarily say, well, I'm going to vote for Democrats if there's not a Green candidate on the ballot. That's not how it works. Some Greens see the Democrats Republicans as basically the same. There's no real difference between them. But, you know, in 2016, Jill Stein got 31,000 votes as the Green Party candidate for president in Wisconsin. Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton by less than 23,000. So if she had been on the ballot, would have changed things? Maybe. But every little bit matters. In a state like Wisconsin, we're talking of the last 6 presidential races, only 2 have been decided by more than 23,000 votes. So it tells you we're almost always on the razor's edge. And every little bit, every decision like this matters about who's on the ballot and who's not.
And we should mention that the Green Party, its co-chair, Dr. Michael White, suggests that it's a misreading of the law, this electors thing, that they don't need elected office holders. Is that their argument?
Yes. This is the high stakes that we have in these legal arguments in Wisconsin. Often gets us into court.
I noticed the Wisconsin Election Commission is also taking up a challenge from Democrats' lawyer against Cornell West being on the ballot. Is that right?
Yeah, there are a couple of different ones. One argues that his papers weren't properly notarized, essentially. The other one argues that there are problems with the signatures. So like, you know, when you circulate nomination papers, you have to meet certain standards about, you know, how they're circulated, how they're dated, how they're signed, things like that, if they have a valid address. And so we often see these challenges. They're not often successful, but sometimes they are. Again, you know, Cornell West in the last Marquette poll wasn't doing very well. We weren't seeing a huge impact from him. But if you're talking 10,000 votes for him, that could have gone somewhere else, that can sway an election in Wisconsin.
Well, all this drama over ballot status is somewhat obscuring what the Democrats hoped would be a post-convention bounce. And all the excitement over Kamala Harris and Tim Walz last week, is there likely to be a bounce?
Good question, because there's somewhat of a bounce already for Harris post-Biden dropping out. traditionally after conventions, you see a bounce for a candidate. It's hard to kind of figure out what bounce we saw for Republicans because, remember, Trump, after the Republican convention, had a really good convention. I mean, he's coming off this assassination attempt that created a lot of goodwill and sympathy for him. They then won the convention in Milwaukee, and all reports were they had a pretty good convention, pretty good messaging out of that. And then, boom, a few days later, Biden drops out. So it kind of took some air out of the balloon of a Trump bounce post-convention. Now we've got Harris in, created all this excitement among Democrats because they weren't feeling great about Joe Biden. They feel much better about Harris. So has she already gotten that bounce from just getting into the race, or is there more to come about this convention? And what we're seeing is really the race to define Kamala Harris. What I know sounds maybe a little odd to people like you and I who are following politics very closely all the time, but a lot of people don't really know Kamala Harris. Yeah, they know she's the vice president, but they don't know her other than being Joe Biden's number two, right? This is her chance to try and say, this is who I am, this is what I want to do, not just being the kind of the shadow or the wingman to Joe Biden. She's racing to define herself as somebody who's been tough on crime as a prosecutor, who will be tough on the border, who will help rein in costs. Republicans, meanwhile, are racing to try and define her somebody who was a dangerously liberal, quote-unquote, prosecutor who let criminals go free, that she's been soft on the border and allowed all these problems to happen, and that she's responsible for the Biden policies that they argue led to inflation.
So we should maybe step down the ballot a notch or two to the U.S. Senate race in Wisconsin. A Democratic incumbent, Tammy Baldwin, spoke to the DNC. Eric Hovde, the Republican, teamed up with J.D. Vance, the vice presidential nominee, at a news conference in Kenosha. Where does that race stand?
Well, the last round of polling that we saw had it kind of where it's been for a while, about a 5-7 point lead for Baldwin. What's been noteworthy in the people I talked to about that race is they are not seeing national Republicans yet come in a major way to help Hovde. Now, it's still late August. There's time. But in looking at the buys between post-primary and November so far, Baldwin and her allies have about a 3-to-1 advantage in money being spent on the air. Now, that's not great if you're a challenger against an incumbent who's decently well-known, got pretty good resources, and knows a very good campaigner. So Hovde needs some help to close that gap. And two, we've been talking a lot this year about the presidential race, how it's going to impact the Senate contest. The idea or thought for a lot of people I talked to Madison was Tammy Baldwin will have to run ahead of Joe Biden. The question is by how much to win re-election. Well, Biden was in the low 40s in some polls we were seeing before he dropped out. Now we've got a 50-50 presidential race. And I stress right now because we're still 70 days away or so from the election. That's almost a lifetime in politics. So if Harris and Trump are like even Steven come November, Baldwin's in pretty good shape, most people tell me. But if Trump pulls ahead, if he's winning Wisconsin by 2, 3, 4 points, it gets tougher. We used to be a state that had a lot of ticket splitters. That phenomenon's kind of died down quite a bit. Granted, 2018 was an exception. Baldwin ran away in that race by 10 points. But her opponent, Leah Vukmir, then a state senator, didn't have very good resources, didn't run a lot of ads in western and northern Wisconsin. And Baldwin did better in places that you wouldn't expect a Democrat to do because she just had more money. This race is not really a problem so far. Hovde's been writing big checks to keep him about even with Baldwin for finances.
We should mention a couple of House seats, at least two House seats in Wisconsin. I heard former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, still a U.S. representative from California, address the Wisconsin delegation last Wednesday at the convention, talking about supporting Peter Barker in the 1st District in Kenosha, Rebecca Cook in the 3rd District in western Wisconsin. Does Pelosi have reason for optimism?
Possibly. Those are some interesting races. Looking at the 3rd, 1st, it looks a little bit kind of closer, top of the ticket, at least in the last, in 2022 cycle. The challenge for Democrats there is you have an incumbent, Derek Van Orden, who has some pretty good money socked away, an interesting challenger, and Rebecca Cook, who used to work as a political operative from Eau Claire, been waiting tables while she campaigns in this race, kind of playing up that I'm an outsider type thing. But in a campaign where Donald Trump can hurt some candidates, especially in suburban areas, he might actually help Van Orden, the western Wisconsin seat, because that's kind of Trumpy territory. So it'll be interesting to watch how Trump does in the 3rd. Did quite well there in 2020 and 2016. Does he have a repeat performance? Because if he does, it probably helps Van Orden. Now, in the first, you know, a little more suburban area, southeastern Wisconsin, Brian Stile has more than $4 million in the bank, last check. Peter Barca is a former revenue secretary for the state. Is actually in that seat, congressional seat, back in 30 years ago, a longtime state lawmaker. He's raised some good money so far, but the campaign's been kind of quiet. It's really, people aren't sure whether that race is going to pop. And looking at the ad reservations, the House Majority PAC, which is aligned with Democrats, put about $4 million in TV time into the third, much more than they did in the first. But those are just reservations. They haven't spent the money yet. We were watching to see if they actually commit to it because 2 years ago, that same group had money laid down for Brad Path as he ran against Van Orden, then an open seat, and pulled out last couple of weeks. You know, by the way, people I talked to think would help if you want to beat an incumbent like Van Orden or Stile. You don't just spend the last couple weeks of the race. You got to get up in the air earlier than that because the areas will be crowded. How do you break through the clutter in a campaign if you're only running the last 2 weeks of a race? That can be tough sometimes.
Okay, JR, we'll talk again soon. Mayan Silver back with you next time.
Oh, anytime.
That was J.R. Ross of WisPolitics.com speaking with me, WUWM's Chuck Kornbach. Check out the Capital Notes podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
The Amazon Prime show The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is a popular series that explores the fictional life of a female stand-up comedian in the late 1950s. We'll find out how it depicts the real history of female Jewish comedians in about 15 minutes. But first, we'll learn about the Milwaukee Road and how it helped people get to national parks. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Yesterday, the National Park Service celebrated its 108th birthday. Since its founding, the National Park System has grown to more than 400 parks that draw in millions of visitors each year. When they were first founded, most people couldn't get to them without taking a train at least part of the way. Even though Wisconsin isn't home to a national park, we did have a role in getting tourists to them. The Milwaukee Road was a local railroad company which, like many others at the time, tried to take advantage of the travel boom to national parks. Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski met with Special Collections librarian Greg Comley at Milwaukee's Central Branch, where he pulled documents from the Milwaukee Road collection.
We received this collection in the early 80s directly from the Milwaukee Road. Their idea before they went bankrupt was to have a place to preserve all of their historical materials. So it is by far one of our biggest collections. There's well over 50,000 engineering architectural drawings, 18,000 plus photographs, and enough boxes to fill your grandmother's house.
So this month we're celebrating the anniversary of the national park systems in the U.S. And while Milwaukee nor Wisconsin has a national park, we did have a role in encouraging people to go out to the parks and out west in general. So can you share a bit about the Milwaukee Road and its role in doing that?
Sure. So first I'll just start with a little bit of background on railroads and national parks in general. Railroads have always had a unique relationship with national parks, long before the National Park Service was even established in 1916. So, for instance, in Yellowstone, the Northern Pacific had already established a line from Livingston to Cinnabar. In 1883, Yellowstone ended up having five railroads that connected to its borders, one being the Milwaukee Road. But we see this all across the country where railroads are capitalizing on their closeness to national parks. And they use it as a way not only to drum up passenger traffic because they care about the bottom dollar, but they also have this unique relationship in with national parks on both promoting them and actively encouraging the public to use them, which makes us have even better national parks.
So they have this kind of mutually beneficial relationship in encouraging people to use the rails and then see the parks. So what did Milwaukee travel with railroads look like during this time?
So the Milwaukee Road, when it first began, was the Milwaukee and Waukesha. It had like 20 different names. It started here in Milwaukee, and its first line was completed to Waukesha in 1850. Milwaukee, you know, has always been the heart of the railroad, but like most other railroads in the country, Chicago is the terminus of the railroad. So, you know, in the late 1800s, it became the Chicago-Milwaukee-St. Paul Railroad, and later the Chicago, when they completed their Pacific line, it was the Chicago-Milwaukee St. Paul Pacific Railroad Company, which is a really big mouthful. So everyone calls it the Milwaukee Road, which was never its official name, but like it's kind of like shortened version, right? So we had a beautiful passenger station here in Milwaukee, but traffic just went through. Of course, it stopped. At some points, there was like 26, 27 passenger trains going through Milwaukee a day. So we always say that Milwaukee is the heart of the railroad because this is where it had its gigantic shops. So Milwaukee is the heart of the railroad, Chicago is the brains. So normally what would happen is you would either take a train from anywhere on the line, which was, for the passenger trains, it was called the Olympian, or they had the Columbian. The Olympian was like the express train. The Columbian stopped at more places. But you would take this from either the Great Lakes area or the West Coast, and you would stop at Three Forks, Montana. And then originally in 1926, when they started marketing this whole thing, you would get on a bus at Three Forks, Montana. And they had some really like, not so much like a bus, but more like an elongated station wagon that could fit people.
Yeah.
And then you would travel the nearly 100 miles to the park border. And this is 1926. So imagine the roads in 1926. Bumpy.
Not a comfortable ride, yeah.
Right. So then you would get on a bus, and then you would travel to Yellowstone, and they created their own entrance to the park. And then you would get on Yellowstone buses that were operated by the park, and you would do like this roundabout tour. And then, you know, they had options where you could either go to a different railroad's entrance. So like you could go to end at West Yellowstone and then go out on UP lines or one of the other places. But it was a really long route through not great roads.
Yeah, it sounds like a commitment and an endeavor. And obviously people need places to stay when they're traveling so far. This isn't, you know, a few day trip. I imagine people are taking at least a week to go out here and see Yellowstone. So one big effort in getting people out to the parks was the construction of the Gallatin Gateway Inn near Yellowstone Park in 1927. So can you share the strategy they built here that would be used at other national parks too?
Sure. So like I mentioned, the Milwaukee Road was at a disadvantage to begin with because they were so far from the park. So what they decided to do was build a very nice, luxurious hotel that was in a town called Salesville, which later changed its name to the Gallatin Gateway. So they built this like Spanish Revival hotel that was really quite magnificent. I guess it was one of the more luxurious railroad hotels of its time. They built it in 4 months in 1927, starting in February, which it was a very large hotel. Like they had to build it so fast that they were like lighting fires to make the walls dry faster. But like a huge kind of engineering feat because they were like shoveling snow off the roof to like build it, right? So they built this wonderful thing. You know, it had a huge dining room, 350 people. It had a ballroom for hundreds to dance in it. But interestingly enough, it only had 20 some rooms in it. And this is because the Olympian and the Columbian passenger trains were overnight trains, sometimes two nights, mm-hmm. depending on which one you took. So you would either arrive in the morning and then you would have lunch, right? And then you would go on your tour of Yellowstone, or you arrive in the afternoon and you didn't really have to stay there. The only people that stay there were the people leaving through the park to go usually back out to the West Coast. Then you would stay a night there. A lot of other railroad companies did this. The Great Northern reached Glacier National Park in 1893 and built a beautiful lodge. The Santa Fe to the south rim of the Grand Canyon. And not only did they build this hotel, the Santa Fe also, you know, led national efforts to make the Grand Canyon a national park.
And the Milwaukee Road Company was the first to build a place for people to stay?
Not in Yellowstone.
Okay.
No. They were always like the last unfortunately. The Milwaukee Road did a lot of great things, yeah. But sometimes they were the last company to finish a transcontinental route. They were the last company to establish a route into Yellowstone, and it actually never did that well. You know, just like some figures, in 1925, there was 45,000 people arriving by rail into Yellowstone. Like, a fraction of these were Milwaukee Road, because the other railroads had like such like a better position. You know, like West Yellowstone is like 18 miles from the border of Yellowstone National Park. So they tried to capitalize. It didn't quite work out, but the hotel is still there. So at least we got this like nice bit, like piece of history that's still there.
Absolutely. And we have some prints of the inn here that you're going to show me in a bit. But when you're researching all of this and you're looking at the growth and some of the challenges that the railroad is facing, what stands out to you about the Milwaukee Road?
The Milwaukee Road, concerning like passenger traffic, what made it such a fantastic railroad was its innovation. At some points in the service, the Milwaukee Road had claimed to have the best passenger service there, with meaning like very punctual trains. It developed its own roller bearings in the trucks, which the cars sit on, that were extremely smooth. Like in the 1930s, regularly trains between Chicago and St. Paul were traveling 100 plus miles an hour in the 1930s. And they claimed that the faster it went, the smoother it goes. So like, you know, they would have like, you know, they did things where they put a cup of coffee like on the table, and the train's like going 100 miles an hour and the coffee's not falling out of the cup.
Yeah.
Right. So, and it did a lot of other really innovative things, like its electrified line out west. So when people were arriving into Three Forks, Montana, like going to the Yellowstone, chances are the train was being pulled by electric locomotive. So it had, when it was built and for quite some time after, the longest electrified route through the mountains. Electricity played a huge role. I mean, it allowed the railroad to, A, reduce operating costs, but it also, you've got these nice electric engines that don't throw off ash and steam and dust, and were much quieter than our steam locomotives. So it was really innovative in how it did that. And especially when we're looking at the western expansion of the railroad, to electrify hundreds of miles of line is one thing, but you have to get the electricity. So they were like using companies to build dams to supply the electricity. So this was like a huge undertaking, and some would say one of the reasons why the Milwaukee Road ended up going bankrupt, but that's another story.
Yeah, another one we could revisit another time. So you're currently here in Milwaukee, but you actually grew up in Wyoming. So in what we're talking about today, how does it feel to be able to pull out these primary documents here in the Midwest and still have a way to connect to Wyoming and out west through what you do here?
You know, because, you know, especially Yellowstone, that it's a national treasure. You know, like you see it pop up all over the place. So like, it's kind of really exciting for me, like when I pull out like all those brochures of Yellowstone and like describing a place where I grew up. And I'm like, oh, even out here in Milwaukee, like you can't get away from like the grandeur and the beauty of some of our national parks, and in particular, Wyoming.
Awesome. Well, Greg, thank you so much for joining me today and for pulling out all these great documents. I look forward to exploring.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
Greg Comley is a special collections librarian at the Milwaukee Public Library. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, and you can see old pictures, documents, and brochures from Milwaukee Road at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we'll explore the history of female Jewish comedians. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The marvelous Mrs. Maisel on Amazon Prime explores the fictional life of a female stand-up comedian in the late 1950s. But while Midge Maisel is fictional, the character is rooted in the real-life history of female Jewish comedians who made their way to the top of the comedy scene despite many obstacles. Grace Kessler-Overbeck explores this as an assistant professor of comedy writing and performance at Columbia College. She joined me earlier this year ahead of a lecture at UW-Milwaukee. So one of the critiques I've heard of the marvelous Mrs. Maisel is that this just couldn't happen, it didn't happen, but your lecture really disproves that notion. When we're looking at the history of specifically Jewish women in comedy and stand-up, when does that story really start?
Well, you could start the story as early as vaudeville in like the turn of the century. When you look at Jewish women comedians, I think they're standing on the shoulders of so many Jewish women singers who did really, really funny musical numbers like Fanny Brice or Sophie Tucker. And I mean, they were both really important vaudeville stars. So I think you could make a case for the Maisel lineage starting, I mean, at least in the 1910s, if not earlier.
When it comes to, you know, comedy and stand-up, who are some of the first women who we see emerging in the comedy scene in the 1950s, the 1960s?
So my personal favorite and the subject of my book, actually, is Jean Carroll. She is the first Jewish woman to do stand-up as we understand stand-up today. So there's no musical numbers, there's no sketches, it's just a person speaking from their individual point of view about their experiences in a really funny way. And she started doing that really as early as the 1940s because she was an MC. So a lot of stand-up emerged out of MCs who would introduce acts in variety shows.
How would you describe her early kind of stand-up to people who might be more familiar with the kinds of stand-up we have now?
It's not a different species from the stand-up that we have now, but it might be like a grandparent in that she was one of the really, really early people to get personal with her stand-up. The earliest stand-up was sort of like reciting a joke book. You know, you would just kind of tell joke after joke after joke, and stand-ups could steal material from one another because the jokes weren't really connected to any kind of personal experience. But around Jean Carroll's time and what she was part of was this transition into what we now think of as stand-up, which is way more personal. It's almost like giving a confession. It's like really leaning into your own experiences and your own personal point of view.
Well, and that feels very Mrs. Maisel. For people who might not be familiar with the show, much of the stand-up that she does in The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is based on her life. I can't really think of, in fact, any stand-up sets that she does that isn't based in her life.
Right. And I think that that's one of the really exciting things about stand-up. And it's one of the reasons I think that so many people from minoritized backgrounds have been drawn to stand-up, because it's a way to give your perspective. It's a way that a different point of view can be really valuable.
You mentioned, of course, Jean Carroll. There were other women who were also doing stand-up at this time. But even today, stand-up comedy more generally is often a boys' club. If you go to an open night, you're going to see a lot of men and maybe just a couple women. What were some of the unique issues that women faced, especially when compared to their male counterparts?
Well, in the 1950s, there was just a illegibility. Like, it's really funny to read reviews of Jean Carroll and some of her contemporaries. I will say there's not a lot in the way of stand-up, like women doing stand-up in the 1950s. In the 1960s, then you had like Phyllis Diller and Joan Rivers, and there were a few more. But a lot of the time, women were allowed to do comedy if they were singing, but there had to be a musical component. And a lot of critics, when reviewing Jean Carroll, will comment, I'm like, there are no songs. Where are her songs? She just talks. And they're extremely puzzled by this. I think just establishing herself as like, no, I'm doing stand-up comedy. Even just marketing yourself as a stand-up comedian was somehow baffling to certain critics and audiences, which is its own obstacle.
Understandable. One of the things that it seems your lecture gets into are the unique challenges that Jewish women faced, specifically the kinds of stereotypes people would have about them. You just mentioned, of course, women in general were stereotyped in that they were thought to be more of a novelty act than their male counterparts. What were some of the issues that Jewish women, Jewish comedians in particular, faced?
So, you know, early stand-up comedy was disproportionately representative of Jewish men. When you think about the people that are associated with, like, the first big stand-up comics, you know, Henny Youngman, Jackie Mason, the list goes on. It's a lot of Jewish men. And it's a lot of Jewish men who are complaining about the women in their lives, their Jewish mothers and their Jewish wives. And these stereotypes became so widely circulated that I've met people who they might have never met a Jewish person before, but they still know what the Jewish mother stereotype is. And so always, before Jean Carroll or Joan Rivers or any Jewish woman even opens her mouth, there is already that sort of ghost of the Jewish mother or the Jewish princess, or, you know, people have really strong stereotypes of what Jewish women are like that are haunting that microphone before the performer even opens her mouth.
How did early comedians work with that, deal with that, acknowledge it, and then move forward from it?
Well, I think part of the strategy is to humanize it. You know, they don't pretend that these expectations don't exist. Sometimes they'll even lean into the expectations. So, I mean, Joan Rivers is really well known for acknowledging the stereotypes about Jewish women, and sometimes even leaning into them. If you listen to, like, the record What Becomes a Semi-Legend Most, she has this really incredible bit where she roasts a woman in the audience for having too small an engagement ring. And she says, "Wait, are you Jewish?" And the woman says, "Yes." And she says, "Well, then you have no excuse for accepting a ring that small." And she's just acting out this kind of stereotypical expectation of Jewish women. But she's doing it, I think, to show that she's in on the joke and that she's sort of mocking that expectation. And she's giving it a face. She's giving it a personality beyond simply this kind of monstrous idea. And I think that was an interesting thing that a lot of comedians were doing. When you humanize a stereotype, when you attach a face and a likable character persona to it, you take away a little bit of its fearsome quality.
It's interesting hearing you describe that, because to me, parts of this mirror the conversations around the marvelous Mrs. Maisel itself. There is, of course, a camp who finds this show very empowering, very interesting to learn about, you know, some aspects of the 1950s. Of course, it is fictional, but there are some real life people who are represented in it. And then there's another camp of people who I think believe it promotes some stereotypes. It does deal in some stereotypes. How do you view that? How do you view the critiques of this program and ultimately the merits?
I mean, I will say that there is a part of me who was just so, like, thrilled with the same kind of zealous joy that I see little girls exhibiting towards Disney princesses, thrilled to see a story that was really resonating in a mainstream way, that was about a Jewish woman being opinionated, being funny, being a comedian. To think that there were millions of Americans who were receptive to this story, it's really meaningful as a Jewish woman. And then, you know, you realize, well, Americans are receptive to this story if the woman is not portrayed in a way that challenges their idea of what Jews and Jewish women are like. You know, I think The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel was a wonderful show. And yeah, I mean, it supported some stereotypes, but I don't think in a really harmful way.
Now, as we look at female Jewish comedians today, who are the women you see who are carrying this same torch for this generation and the next?
Thank you for asking that question. I'm so excited about how many amazing Jewish women are doing work today. I just saw an incredible Netflix special by Jacqueline Novak, who is brilliant. I'm a really big fan of Sass Goldberg, who is a comedian and also a producer. Of course, Sarah Silverman is legendary and incredible. I'm also really excited about Rachel Bloom and the work that she's doing. Tiffany Haddish is brilliant and had an amazing special called Black Mitzvah, which is all about, not all, but largely about her life as a Black Jewish woman and the ways that that has been difficult to navigate. And I think, you know, with Tiffany Haddish and Rain Pryor, I mean, there are so many Black Jewish women in comedy. I mean, Rashida Jones, there are a lot of women whose that hasn't really been part of what they've discussed, but it's definitely part of their background. And so I'm excited for people to get into that and sort of expand their understanding of what Jewish women comedians look like.
Grace Kessler-Overbeck is an assistant professor of comedy writing and performance at Columbia College. We spoke earlier this year. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Join us again tomorrow at noon when we'll tell you about some local restaurant closures and what's new in town. Plus, we'll bring you the latest in our music series, Live at Lake Effect. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.